Good afternoon and welcome to the LaRouche Show. It's Saturday, May 1st, 2010. May Day for those of you keeping track. I'm Harley Schlanger. I'll be your host today. It would be a great understatement to say that these are truly momentous times. In 1 week, we'll have the next webcast by Lyndon LaRouche. That is next Saturday, May 8th at 1 p.m. Eastern Time on the LaRouche PAC website. But those of you who have been following the website closely have seen that Lyndon has been on there virtually every other day with extremely important statements, interventions on the nature of physical economy, on the nature of the scientific revolution that has to be launched. And so if you're not going on the LaRouche PAC website on a daily basis, you can't really be said to be in this world. At the present, we're in the midst of the final breakdown of the Anglo-Venetian imperial financial system. As both Lyndon and Helga Zepp LaRouche had forecast, the European system is collapsing. As Lynn once said, there's only one thing wrong with the euro, it's no damn good. So when you hear the phrase Greek crisis, realize that this is a cover-up. It's not just Greece, which is collapsing. It's the whole European Monetary Union which is crashing, including, and most importantly, the economy of the mothership of the European Union, Great Britain. As for the United States, we are getting a steady diet of lies from President Obama and his stable of corrupt and lying economists, each one of whom has been discredited. But their lies can't change the facts. Not only is there no recovery, but the situation is worsening. Now we have the revelations of systemic fraud, not just by Goldman Sachs, not just by Lehman Brothers, but all the banks that are considered too big to fail. They're all under investigation. We're finally getting to what we called for a couple of years ago, a PCORA commission to investigate this. And all of this shows once again that LaRouche is right. It's a systemic-wide failure. It's the whole system. So if you wish to survive, there are a couple of things that we immediately have to do. Two steps in particular. One, first and foremost, impeach Obama or convince him to leave. One way or the other, if he's not out of there, there's no way to get a solution to the crisis. And secondly, adopt the broad outlines of the LaRouche plan, which includes specifically a global Glass-Steagall, and secondly, a four powers agreement. And with an angry population hungry for answers and looking for solutions, these measures, which seemed improbable even 2 or 3 months ago, are closer than ever to happening. But there's one other thing we have to do besides the impeachment and the LaRouche plan, and that's the subject of today's program. We have to develop a new periodic table. The original periodic table, which most people, most listeners probably remember from your chemistry classes in high school, was developed by Dmitri Mendeleev in the late 19th century. But according to one of our guests today, Mendeleev's periodic table must now be, quote, subsumed by a larger system called cosmic radiation, unquote. That guest is Peter Martinson, who published a groundbreaking article in the April 23rd issue of the Executive Intelligence Review titled Towards a New Periodic Table of Cosmic Radiation. Our other guest today recently shocked an audience, a full house at the Wilshire Plaza Hotel in Los Angeles, when he told them why this project is a matter of life and death for civilization. Cody Jones told them that our sun could go supernova within the next 5 billion years, and we are not prepared for that. And if we don't start preparing for it now, it will be too late. So today we're going to take up the question of the scientific revolution, which must accompany the LaRouche plan if we wish to survive. It's a scientific revolution that's being worked through on the grounds of the basement of the House of Lyndon LaRouche by a dedicated group of LaRouche Youth Movement members. So I'd like to welcome to our program today Peter Martinson and Cody Jones.
Thanks, Harley.
Hello. Thanks, Harley.
So, Peter, let's start with you. And first of all, I'd actually like to ask you, because you just came from a discussion with Lyndon LaRouche, you make very clear in your article that this is a scientific revolution that really should have happened maybe 80 years ago, that there were people such as Max Planck and Albert Einstein who were working on these kinds of issues, but it was postponed till today. Why is this so important today that we take up these kinds of questions?
Oh, well, I think actually I can kill two birds with one stone here. Something Lynn LaRouche went through earlier today, I think, gets at that very precisely in our leadership discussion. He was making the point that the big problem we have today is that human society in general, human civilization, has degenerated just completely. He says that people today are stupider than they're stupider today than he knows of in all of human history. And it's been a degeneration, a very rapid degeneration. And he said, if you compare that with, he just had very high-level discussions, international discussions on Thursday, an international, essentially, conference call, which he says, if you compare the conference call that he had with leading people around the world with the type of discussions that you see regularly anywhere in the world, in governments, anywhere else, you can see that they're in two different universes. He said that our mission as the LaRouche movement is to turn this around and break people out of the stupid habits that have made them stupid in thinking. And he said, for example, you have to look at history in this way. History is a fight among individuals with profound ideas and then fights against profound ideas. He said, for example, you look at Abraham Lincoln. Abraham Lincoln's life up to his death was he transformed the mission of statecraft globally. And this was represented after his death in 1876 when the United States had the first Centennial Exhibition, which was essentially a scientific conference in the United States. Mm-hmm. Where we invited people from around the world to come and see the advances in science and technology that we've made, and also to exhibit the advances that other countries have made. One of the key participants in this was Dmitry Mendeleev himself, who was actually a high-level political figure inside of Russia, along with doing all of his work on physical chemistry. But LaRouche said, you have to look at what Mendeleev himself was thinking, because he's a scientist. He was the one that pushed and developed the Trans-Siberian Railroad on the model of what he saw at the 1876 Centennial Convention here, the model of the American Transcontinental Railroad. Mendeleev went back and said, we have to have one of these for Russia. And LaRouche said, you actually can't understand that clearly in terms of physical economics unless you look at Mendeleev's process of development of the periodic table of elements. Because how Mendeleev thought was in terms of industrializing Russia and developing the natural resource base of Russia, which means understanding the physical chemistry of the elements and minerals and so forth that you find in the ground, that you find in water sources and so forth. Mendeleev wanted to develop Russia, industrialize it, and he saw that in order to do that, in order to make physical discoveries and at the same time apply them to improving life on the earth, you had to do things like build economic infrastructure like the railroad. So LaRouche's point is, in order to understand history and in order to understand physical economics, you have to get inside the mind of the scientific thinker, because our mission as a movement is to break people out of these crap habits of thinking and get them into a higher domain where they can think about new ideas. So that's part of why we're developing this concept of a new periodic table.
Well, Peter, let me just to broaden that question. So you've identified the role of one particular scientist, Mendeleev, both in advancing scientific thinking and also applying that level of thinking to improve physical economy. Now, you mentioned at the beginning that LaRouche said that the population is dumber because you have these this fight between those like Mendeleev who come up with profound ideas and then those who attack those ideas. What is it that was done to attack the ideas of those like Mendeleev and Vernadsky and Einstein to, first of all, convince the scientific community that they had to retreat from these profound ideas and then spread the manure on top of the population?
Well, the whole thing actually stems from the British Empire, from one main individual named Bertrand Russell, also known as Dirty Birdie, who LaRouche characterized as the most evil man in the 20th century. There, from what I understand, there were two avenues. One in Russia was characterized by a guy named Oparin. This is after Mendeleev was dead, and Vladimir Vernadsky was essentially running Russian science, Russian-Ukrainian science. Vernadsky said, on the one hand, life is an irreducible principle of the universe. It can't be reduced to abiotic processes, and at the same time, cognition is not reducible to life or abiotic. The attack came on him by certain people inside the Communist Party and so forth who were working as witting or unwitting agents of the British Empire. But they said, no, Vernadsky's wrong. All life comes from chemistry. All life comes from abiotic material, from dirt, from rocks, essentially. That you have to build everything up from non-living material. And this is Oparin and the materialists and so forth in Russia.
So the famous materialism of the Russian school.
Right. At the same time, in Europe and then into the United States, up through before World War II into World War II, there was a similar current called the positivist movement, which took out its aggression specifically on Max Planck, and then also Einstein, who stood up to defend Max Planck, who said that you have to reduce everything to essentially sense perceptions, basic principles of kinetic interactions, instead of looking for, so in other words, you have to show that every effect comes from some specific cause. And so you have to go down the chain of command, essentially, to the first cause, which has to be some type of sense perceptible activity.
Well, Peter, you open your article by talking about a series of lectures Planck gave on thermodynamics in 1909, in which he opened by presenting this positivist view and then demolished it. So Planck was absolutely clear that this is what he was facing.
Absolutely. Yeah, everybody was clear that this positivist movement was a big problem. Because what it removes from science is true causality, which is that the universe is ordered and that it's headed towards higher orderings that you can't get from any closed, kinetic, purely thermodynamic system. So yeah, Planck was clear about this. Einstein was very clear. Also, the Gestalt psychologist, Wolfgang Köhler, was clear that you really can't get down to explaining anything in physics unless you have a concept of what Curler called a gestalt, or like a higher overall dynamic, which determines what all the parts are doing, as opposed to the positivist idea, which is that you have to explain everything by adding up from the parts.
Right, everything comes from the ground up.
Right, and I think that this this operation, which was run by the British, and you can find the roots in Bertrand Russell, and then later on, John von Neumann, who was at some of these Solvay conferences where the quantum mechanics was debated, and also Norbert Wiener, this conception that the universe has to be explained in terms of fundamental particles of rock knocking together, creating everything up to life and cognition, became the predominant belief, especially through the 1960s and 1970s. And so today, we have a problem where nobody understands physical economics except for LaRouche, and then a couple people are beginning to approximate that around the world.
And
but that's
Peter,
the main
problem. You studied science at a major university. Was it dominated? Were your scientific studies dominated by this positivist worldview?
Yeah. What you never get to is the fact that scientists actually make discoveries. I was taking physics classes and astronomy classes, but looking back, they were really just mathematics classes. You never learn how somebody actually makes a discovery or principle. You only figure out how could you derive their so-called discovery from essentially basic principles through mathematical deduction.
Well, you're listening to Peter Martinson. This is the LaRouche Show. We're looking into this question of the scientific revolution, which has to accompany the political mobilization to defeat the British Empire, rid our nation of the now hated presidency of Barack Obama and the gutless lunatics in the Congress. But at the same time, if we don't have a scientific revolution, we're not going to succeed. I'd like to bring in our second guest, Cody Jones, who, as I mentioned earlier, gave a very shocking presentation in Los Angeles, but who brought it back to the same basic point, which is mankind is not going to survive without a transformation in the thinking of science. Cody, what was the response you got from the people? I don't mean the immediate response, but what's your sense of the response we're getting from the scientific layer, the population in general, to taking up these broad issues and making them immediately political?
Well, it's mixed. I think some people are, well, on one hand, you've got from layers which typically have been the layers which in the population have been cast aside. We're talking about layers of the population that often live in the ghettos or come from less educated circles. This actually tends to be the grouping which is most open to getting on board and accepting this kind of a scientific and cultural revolution, largely because they live in the depths of this hell with this crap around them and are happy about the prospect of even getting off this planet, which hasn't been too kind to them of late. So it's you're seeing a lot of receptivity there, but I think because this does offer people a sense of hope, and most importantly, it does squarely put on the table this concept of the future and a real living idea of immortality. And so people who are groping in the dark often for some meaning to their existence and understanding of why am I here? What is the role that my grandfather contributed to history? What does the future hold for my children and grandchildren? As we present them with the prospect that we are, though on the cusp of the greatest dark age in hell the planet has ever seen, we've also got the greatest potential for a fundamental revolution in science, in culture, and just man's general outlook for his existence. And so people run to that idea. They like the idea that there's no ability in the universe. They like the idea that what they do with their lives, though it may be finite in itself, can contribute to an infinite process of development for mankind. Well, so these layers are open to it.
And LaRouche has basically subsumed this revolution with the term cosmic radiation. What is
right.
the significance of the idea of cosmic radiation from this standpoint?
Well, what it does is it starts to frame the activity of the Earth, per se, or life, cognition, in the context of a unified system that, though in most people's minds they see maybe the Earth and then some distance away you've got Mars and then some greater distance away you might have stars or supernovae or something like that, it's still in the context of a general empty space with objects in it. Now, what the cosmic radiation idea does is it sort of unifies all of these seemingly discrete objects into one unified dynamic system. We've got a certain kind of unified process of development going on, which to a certain extent is mediated and facilitated by this exchange of cosmic radiation, cosmic activity. But that it has to be, it takes on the character of something like a developing living organism, you know, which starts off as a very small little, maybe single-celled organism, but over time develops, becomes more complex, more diverse, more organized, but as one unified process. And so this starts to bring the universe and bring the elements of the universe into that kind of context of one unified dynamic of development.
Well, Peter, let me go to you now. This idea of empty space, that is, in fact, the idea of the empiricist, the positivist, that if you look out across a room, as you point out in your article, you see certain objects you might walk into. So you assume those are material, and then you assume everything else in between where you see nothing is empty. Well, why is that not true?
You can start from the question of human sense perceptions. We know that we all have sense perceptions. Most people can see, most people can hear, and so forth. We have various senses, and they register certain effects that you interpret as objects, like, okay, I have a table here. Okay, there's a book here, and they're objects. And for the longest time, you imagine, oh, well, these objects must be existing with nothing in between them, unless they're touching each other or colliding with each other and so forth. But through thousands of years of just regular human activity, we realize that our sense perceptions are usually telling us the wrong thing. And, you know, you get this all the time in things like courtroom hearings, where you have a witness out there, he tells one story, and you can essentially get the witness to tell any story you want, depending on how you ask the questions. They're never exactly sure what they see, and everybody sees something different. So it's obvious that our senses are telling us only part of the story. In other words, we actually have made discoveries in the past, like, for example, gravitation, of principles that are determining what the supposed sense objects are doing, but you can't see the principles with any of your senses. Therefore, you can't assume that what you think is empty space is empty space, because there are still principles acting in there. But what I'd say is what we need to do to... people are talking about going to Mars. There's a lot of discussion about going to Mars, even though Obama just decided to cut the whole program and turn the United States into... make us go backwards another huge step, one large step backwards for mankind. There's a lot of discussion about going to Mars, but there's not a lot of discussion about is what's going to happen to our people when they go between the Earth's orbit and Mars's orbit. LaRouche proposes we actually make, for the first time in human history, experimental spacecraft that are designed to accelerate constantly through space, because we know that there are magnetic fields, electric fields, gravitational fields, cosmic radiation of all different sorts in between the Earth and Mars. And we need to drive experimental spacecraft through that system in an accelerated way to create an artificial gravity to see what happens and load these spacecraft up with recording devices so that when the thing blows up for one reason or another, we can actually go back and see what happened on the ship. We can figure out what is this supposedly empty space in between Earth and Mars, which we're going to find out is actually extremely packed, dense.
And Peter, this gets back to one of the leading questions that was raised by Planck and others, which is the relationship between particles and waves. What is there out there? And in this sense, when you're looking at the expansion or the subsuming of the periodic table, you're talking about including other things which presently are not, don't fit into the categories that exist on the periodic table. You mentioned isotopes and certain other kinds of energetic phenomena. What is it you're talking about in terms of the periodic table then?
Yeah, this is something that we're defining more and more. Mendeleev's table was a clear case of a scientific discovery. But it's not complete. Since his discovery, there have been over and over and over new discoveries of the principles of the elements themselves, the principles of nuclear physics, which became called nuclear chemistry, of how do the atoms interact with each other in terms of what's happening in the nucleus. But what we found are thousands of variations of the different elements. Each of these variations have their own characteristics in terms of electromagnetic radiation. For example, each element emits its own characteristic spectra of wavelengths of light, colors of light. At the same time, to go a little bit deeper into this, Cody referenced earlier the idea of actually developing a unified system in the universe that unifies all the domains, the non-living, the living, and the cognitive. We're doing a bunch of research now on how creatures interact with this periodic table of elements. Vernadsky actually had a program of mapping out a new periodic table based on what minerals, what types of elements are used in biological processes, and use the biological processes themselves as the periodic properties, per se. But what we found over the past several decades is very well known that living creatures are very selective on which isotope of element they use. For example, chlorophyll in photosynthesis selects, it has a magnesium atom. It's a ring of atoms, essentially, with a magnesium atom at the center. And then there's this antenna that comes off of the whole thing. But it's been determined that the process of creating photosynthesis inside the cell, creating chlorophyll inside the cell, selects one of three common isotopes of magnesium. It doesn't pick the lightest isotope. It doesn't pick the heaviest isotope. It picks one right in the middle, very specific, which there's no chemical difference between the isotopes. It's some other way the living creature selects the isotope that's important. We don't know what that is yet. So the isotopes come into play if you're going to look at a new periodic system based on how the elements interact with living processes, and then how the cosmic radiation, which we can develop this more, how the cosmic radiation actually impacts and changes living processes on the Earth. So there you have an intersection of the isotope function with cosmic radiation. So it's essentially going to be a living periodic table.
So, and it's a highly differentiated process from what you've just described. I noticed in your article you mentioned, you compare this to the development of counterpoint by Bach. And clearly, I, from what you just said, it becomes more clear to me why that's the case. Cody, let me just come back to you then. In looking at this, we're obviously reliving the crucial developments in the history of science. The battles, the Solvay conferences, for example, the interventions of people like the Russellites. Recently, Lucius has mentioned the role of Hilbert in trying to impose mathematics on this kind of approach to physics. How, just give people a sense of how we're doing this, because clearly we're talking about both new research, but to get to the new research, you have to go through what's been done. What are you guys doing in the basement to get at this thing?
Well, the principal thing is going through the process of reliving the fundamental discoveries of the past. And you can, generally, you get a very quick sense from any individual what side of the fight they're on. Those who tend to be on the humanist side will tend to make jokes and be more lively and present things in a much more human way, whereas the positivists and others are very rigid and mathematical in their presentation of ideas. So it's, you know, you often very quickly, as you're sifting through a number of different people and minds and presentations, you start to quickly get a sense of which ones were on the side of humanity, who had a real love and passion for the human mind and for the good, and those who are clearly there just to deaden the process. I mean, you do have, it's a similar thing you brought up, it's interesting, the Solvay conferences. It's no accident that while many people know of some of the fights that took place there in Copenhagen, where Niels Bohr effectively led these witch hunts against Einstein, against Planck, against those who refused to buy into the statistical positivist approach to quantum physics, to say, well, there's no ability to know truth. You can't know principle. All you can know is statistical correlations of things in the very small. That essentially it's random, but there is some sort of statistical correlations you can draw, and from that you can develop a mathematics that can give you some level of predictivity about what's going to occur in the future.
Hey, Cody, just one thing on that. What you just described is actually the way the derivatives market functions, the same process of using statistical correlations to make bets of huge amounts of money and based on probability.
Right, yeah, exactly. Now, it's funny, the same Niels Bohr, and this is less known, also sponsored a series of conferences around that same time, late 30s and 40s, dealing with questions of biology, where they put forward the idea that biology from this point on was going to be nothing but molecular biology, and all of and everything was going to be in terms of genetics and DNA. Now, this is in complete contradiction to the work that was also coming out of Russia from people who are associated with the likes of Vernadsky, namely a guy, Alexander Gurevich, who he and then some of his students after him were really working on this idea that that which is organizing and determining biological processes is not simple abiotic molecular interactions, but is actually a coherent field process, that you've got the acts of mitosis, that is cell division and growth, differentiation, was all occurring through an interaction and communication amongst cells, utilizing things like light quanta, that it was utilizing a certain kind of biological radiation to coordinate and create differentiation in the living organism, which again sheds some light and gets us back to how we can orient as we start to develop this idea of a new periodic table. The fact that you get certain kinds of so-called molecular constellations in the living process, where you get a collection of different molecules, but they're not bound in the typical way according to sharing of electrons or simple chemical gradients, but they're bound according to a certain kind of coherent field process in the living organism, which tends to indicate that the so-called abiotic molecules or particles that they're utilizing actually aren't simply hard body particles, but themselves must have a quality of resonance to them, must actually have more of a wave type of quality such that they can participate in this kind of coherent organization.
So then that gets back to what Peter was talking about, the way different biological organisms select the isotopes or the various processes in which they participate.
Yeah, exactly. That we're moving away from the idea that you've got that the universe is built out of a bunch of fundamental hard balls which somehow are all stuck together and arranged through these magical forces. But in fact, everything, whether it be things which we recognize as radiation, like light or something, or that which people typically think as hard and material, that everything is in fact of a quality of a type of wave function, a resonance function. And so that really what you're looking at is a coherent system of resonances, and it's the interaction of these different kind of resonant fields which produce the singularity effects, which most people tend to think of as the hard material. But the hard material is really just a singularity in an otherwise set of interrelating coherent fields.
I'd like to invite our listeners to send in your questions if you have some. We're going to continue our discussion. We have a little less than a half hour to go. We may not get to your questions on the air, but if they're good questions and you send them into radio@larouchepub.com, that's radio, at R-A-D-I-O, at LaRouchePub, LaRouchePub.com. If we don't get to them on the air, I think Peter or Cody will probably be able to send you a response. I want to remind our listeners again, next Saturday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time on LaRouchePack.com, there will be a webcast, another international webcast from the Washington, D.C. area, featuring Lyndon LaRouche on the crisis before us and the solutions to that crisis. You're not going to want to miss it. The LaRouche Show will be preempted by Mr. LaRouche's presentation, which of course makes a lot of sense since we want you to listen to that. So next week there'll be no program, but there will be the LaRouche webcast. Now, Peter, what I'd like to do is take a few minutes to then focus in on what precisely how we would end up changing what would people know as the changes in the periodic table that you're discussing? How, what would that look like?
Well, to be honest, I'm not exactly sure yet. We're in the middle of putting together the picture right now. What we've got are a bunch of questions, but a lot of the knowledge that we have right now in terms of physical chemistry, how the isotopes interact with biology, and so forth, a lot of that will be put into a new structure. I don't think it'll look like the wall chart that you get in, you know, your high school chemistry class.
But there would be some kind of ordering, harmonically ordered process, you might say.
Yeah. I mean, it's possible we're going to order it in terms of energy flux densities. A while back, Lynn proposed that we measure energy flux density of an economy based on wavelength of radiation hitting a square centimeter of area, that the higher frequencies of light that hit this tiny piece of area represent higher energy flux densities. Like, for example, going from nuclear fission, which is a very high energy flux density, to nuclear fusion, which is almost unlimited in the density that you can concentrate the activity inside of a nuclear fusion reactor. So we might organize, we might end up organizing the whole thing in terms of increasing scale of energy flux density. Because another thing we know is that life, since its inception, almost the first act of life on the Earth was to increase the energy flux density of simple sunlight hitting the surface of the Earth with the introduction of photosynthesis, which looks like it happened in multiple different ways early on. I read somewhere that the going estimate is that there were 45 different attempts at photosynthesis early on, according to the fossil record. So that was the first real act of life, was to concentrate sunlight into a highly dense form, a much higher form than you get from just simple sunlight. And then the plants and other organisms that developed this power concentrated it into changing the chemistry and lithosphere of the rocks and so forth. So through the fossil record of life, through the evolutionary development of life from the beginning, you've seen an increase in energy flux density, or constantly increasing, but more or less rapid rates of increase of energy flux density. So we might end up, and then different periods are actually associated with different elements that are worked on. Like there's like an iron period, for example, about 2 billion years ago, where creatures used photosynthesis to concentrate iron deposits. So you could almost develop a new periodic table based on energy flux densities in that way.
Well, the implications of what you're talking about is that in addition to finding or creating new elements, we certainly would get a different understanding of what's already here and how it can be utilized.
I mean, that's the other aspect of it, because we're looking at using this process to create a true unified field theory, which means also looking at one of the least understood fields, which is human cognition. A while back, one of our associates posed an idea of an isotope economy, that we need to look at. We're entering a period which would be called the isotope economy, where the dealings would no longer be in just, you know, how much steel you're going to supply, but which type of steel in terms of what isotopes are you going to incorporate into that new material, which means that we're going to have to begin creating new isotopes that don't even exist, concentrating isotopes that are very rare. We'll be changing the composition, the abundance of composition of material on the surface of the Earth and then into space. And so this will have direct bearing on economics, because what that means is we need to go with nuclear fusion research immediately. We need to have nuclear fission all over the place. For example, we're actually running out of helium-3, which you get out of nuclear fission plants. We need to revamp nuclear fission, if only to get helium-3. So we're going to have to incorporate the process of human cognition into the whole shebang, so to speak.
I mean, it sounds like what you're saying, and this is something that I've been working on for years in terms of developing an economic pedagogy, is that we're dealing on the one hand with energy flux densities, you just described it, But it's directly related to potential relative population density, because with any existing technology, you have rates of attrition. The more successful your economy, the more rapidly you're depleting the so-called raw materials. And so civilization has always, at least when it's sane, operated from this standpoint. So, Cody, I guess this is the broader point that you were making in your polemic about the soon-to-be-lost sun, that it's not just a question of planning where in the universe you can hide, but we've got work to do to better define our relationship with the physical universe.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, all of human history is proof to us, if it's approached truthfully, if it's approached the way Lyndon LaRouche does, all of human history is proof that, in fact, the universe exists in such a way that it's accessible to man's mind. In other words, man has demonstrated an ability to master and gain a greater understanding of exactly how the universe is organized, to such effect that we increase the level and rate of organization of that universe. That, you know, through something like this process that Peter's bringing up of unlocking the power of transmutation, so to speak, that, for example, we have all kinds of preliminary indications that isotopes, in that the selectivity of isotopes in living processes may not just simply be that life is selecting one isotope from a different one out of its environment, but that, in fact, life may be creating new isotopes internal to it, that it may be utilizing certain elements of cosmic radiation to carry out a kind of transmutation of elements from one isotope into another internally. Now, to the extent that we can really discover and understand that principle and harness it, we now will have the ability to, at an even greater rate, with greater abundances, start to carry out this kind of transmutation process of creating those resources which we deem necessary for our continued survival and development. You know, and extend this to how would you start to sort of transmutate and develop the surface of Mars as then a jumping off point for how you would do that on an even grander scale in the universe at large.
And this also gets back to biology, because if you treat biology as essentially crunching numbers in genetic coding, which is mostly what's happened, you're missing the whole point that you're making, which is that the creation of new isotopes and the relationship of those to both the living and the cognitive opens up whole new areas in looking at the health and development of human beings physically and cognitively, no?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, right now, I mean, as you're well aware, pretty much the approach to things like cancer is literally just the slash and burn approach. And there's a total lack of understanding of what's really behind things like cancer and other deadly diseases. Whereas what we're approaching is saying, well, things like cancer really should be understood as more of a kind of a disruption in an otherwise coherent harmonic process, to where to deal with these problems is not just a simple mechanistic destructive approach, but one in which becomes more of how do you retune the biological process such that it can itself take out these destructive elements? How do you retune the biological process to extend and prolong the health of the biological organism or the human being? And so it really is getting into this idea that the universe as a whole is a kind of a harmonic process. Everything has to be understood in terms of harmonic resonances and coherence. And you know, we do that, it's going to open up a whole new domain of potentiality for human existence.
Now, Peter, we do have a question that was sent in by one of our listeners, the regular Adam from East Stroudsburg, Pennsylvania. And he wants you to explain to him what is meant by transuranic elements in respect to an extended periodic table.
That's an interesting question. I mean, physically, uranium is that's the last element we get to before we start doing things like nuclear reactions. It's the last naturally occurring element, and it's also one of the radioactive elements. But in terms of transuranic, a big question that exists is what are these atoms? What are these? You know, Mendeleev looked at the elements as they're the principles of change in chemical compounds. So, for example, if you take carbon, does not have a set of its own properties. Carbon in graphite versus carbon in diamond versus carbon in charcoal, you have three completely different materials. No one would ever say that diamond is going to act like charcoal or like graphite, but yet it's all the same. It's all just carbon. Mendeleev's concept was that elements are the principles of change in chemistry. But a bigger question in my mind and to a couple people through the 20th century was what exactly composes these elements? Are they built up? For example, Harkins, William Draper Harkins, made a lot of breakthroughs on how are these elements composed, and he hypothesized that it was a combination of heliums and hydrogens which build up to the highest elements. But a better conception is perhaps the construction of the elements actually starts from the other end, because what we see as a naturally occurring process is not nuclear fusion. We have nuclear fusion in the sun, we think, but a naturally occurring process that we know of is decay, radioactive decay.
Right.
Essentially heavy elements flinging off parts of themselves to create lower and lower elements. And each element can itself be located on one of these decay series. So a question for the higher elements is, are we headed towards some concept of the elements being composed from the top instead of being built up from the bottom? Is there do all the elements come out of a decay process? On the other hand, you have what Cody was raising, which is that there is a lot of evidence of at least organisms taking elements like sodium and transmuting it into magnesium, actually doing a nuclear fusion reaction inside of cells, which would actually give you the heavier elements.
Huh. You know, just from this discussion so far, you can see the potential that's untapped at this point. And with the budget cuts in the space program, with the money going increasingly towards speculation and away from research and development, you see that we're actually going in the wrong direction. So let me throw out to both of you, does everybody capitulate to the positivists? I mean, are there pockets in the world, maybe some of the old Russian scientific networks, maybe in China? Do you know in the United States, are there people who understand why Planck and Einstein never capitulated to the so-called quantum physicists, and why they continued with their opposition? What do you know out there? What exists? Either of you.
Well, it's a mixed bag. I mean, this is the thing, is that you're now getting to the point where you're some two, three generations removed from that more enlightened classical current. And so what you get is, amongst the better people, what you'll tend to find are people who don't accept current opinion about science. They recognize that there must be more out there. But one of two things happens. They have to take their sort of insight that they might have, a certain kind of real insight they have, and they have to figure out, well, how do I form fit it? How do I sell it and package it in such a way that I can get the funding necessary to continue and do my research? Or it sort of drifts off into a form of kookery. They could have latched on to something, get an insight into something, but then that one particular thing now becomes that which they use as a blanket statement for trying to understand the totality of the universe. And so part of our task is to start to bring and rein in some of these people. One, to recognize they've got to get political to change the mission orientation of the nation and the world so that there is the necessary funding and focus and drive for the kind of research that they would like to be doing. And then two, also to sort of bring them into the fold that we're creating of going back to the real founders of science, going back to Kepler, to Riemann, to Einstein, and also the cultural dynamic that encompasses all that, the Bach tradition, etc., to sort of bring them into a saner social process to where they can take that real unique human insight they have and express it in a much saner domain.
And Peter, you have some thoughts on this?
Yeah, I mean, I'd say one thing. We need to get LaRouche's plans implemented really fast, because there are a lot of people out there. There are a lot of people out there who are just essentially bought and paid for academicians that are they're just going to, you know, push the positivist, Newtonian, Euclidean line. But then there are, like Cody is saying, there are pockets of people that are they're honestly trying to make some discoveries. They're honestly trying to do some real science. They're kind of scattered about. There are a couple, you know, little conferences that are had periodically that bring people together, like, for example, cold fusion conferences. A lot of these guys are hovering around this astrobiology program. Like, Sky Shield just went to this conference down in Texas this last week.
Yeah.
But they tend to be wacky in their theories when you talk to them personally. But then the papers that they write are usually very tame. They might have like a very interesting hypothesis, but they're usually very tame. Because if they're not very tame and they're presenting actual discoveries, more often than not, you know, the hand of Satan will come down and crush them in the form of revoking funding, taking away funding, preventing the publication of their papers, essentially driving them into driving taxis instead of doing science. So if we had a good economy, which was promoting things like this, which is where Mendeleev comes back in, he was fighting to have a good economy, and out of that came a whole selection of very qualified, competent scientists like Vernadsky because of the economic changes that were made. If we could do that globally, then we'd find a lot of people would respond and decide to kick against pricks. Instead of just, you know, talk secretly about their wild theories.
Well, then that brings us to the importance of such things as the fight for restoring a full Mars mission, also the development that was never really completed of Mendeleev and Count Sergei Vita to complete the Trans-Siberian Rail process with the Bering Strait Tunnel to connect Eurasia and the American hemisphere. So we have these kinds of projects out there that are part of the LaRouche plan, part of the Four Powers Agreement. Now that brings me back to talking about the space program, to Cody's alarming news about the sun. So Cody, what is it that you're looking at when you present this to someone? What are we talking about? The sun is really on its last legs, huh?
Yeah, well, the sun, like any kind of phenomenon, is part of a process, a constantly changing process. And so the sun, it served us well up to this point. It's been around roughly 5 billion, and it has a lifespan of about 10 before it starts going through certain changes, an expansion to a red giant, and then at a certain point it'll become a nova. I mean, this is a common phenomenon in the galaxy. This happens to all stars of the type that our sun is. So it's lawful. It's part of a dynamic, changing universe. We just have to recognize that the end of the sun does not have to mean the end of humanity, the end of civilization, that it played a necessary role up to this point, but in the 5 billion years up to now and the 5 billion we have left, we've been endowed with such a potential that we can discover those principles by which the sun came into existence, such that we could replicate that if we need to somewhere else, and to recognize that we have the inherent potential to leave this solar system, to go beyond, that we are not a creature of our solar system. It's really the mind of man, the creative potential, which bounds the solar system as a whole. And so it's the extent that we recognize and act according to that kind of identity that this really just becomes, you know, a natural challenge, which I think we can definitely deal with.
Well, I know that a lot of our listeners are probably quite intrigued by the ideas that the two of you have presented. What are we going to be doing to get this out on the LaRouche PAC website? I know there are some very exciting ideas that are being discussed in terms of shorter documentary films, the fundamental issues in science, the work that's being done by Shauna on Einstein. What can you tell us that people can look forward to coming out on the LPAC website in the near future?
Right now, we're in the middle of launching a series of videos, type of educational series of videos, which we'll be able to compose as an actual pedagogical website so that you can actually choose different paths of a type of a curriculum. The first video that's coming out of the series is mainly being steered by a couple of us in the basement, Sky, Ben Denniston, and a couple people in Percival. It's a joint project. First one coming out is going to be focused specifically on the issue of empty space and the fact that empty space only exists in the minds of liberals, but that this comes up very clearly. It's going to be a pedagogical on what we're going to run into when we try to accelerate and plow through the space between the Earth and Mars. And then from out of there, we're going to have several series and tracks of a regular video series, which takes a bunch of the work we're doing in the basement and puts it in onto the screen so that people can understand it.
Well, you know, Peter, I liked one of the things you said near the beginning of your article on empty space, where you said that space is as empty as the open ocean, and that fortunately there were navigators who developed shipping routes, because otherwise it would have been dangerous or impossible to travel. So that is, in a sense, the major part of the importance of what we're opening on the cosmic radiation question, that if you are going to go from here to Mars, you're going to encounter things that are not yet mapped, so to speak.
Yeah, exactly. And that's the importance of the existence of the human mind, and the fact that we have in a physical science sense, an immortal soul, because it's going to be human minds that actually map routes, which incorporate accelerated routes through the solar system, so that we can actually begin colonizing and making sense of this system, and then eventually leaving our system and going to other star systems and colonizing our whole galaxy. That's the mission of humanity, I think.
And in that sense, we're following on the important work of the great scientist Nicolas of Cusa, whose work paved the way for the European culture to cross the Atlantic and map out the creation on this new continent, or this continent, of a new kind of government, a republic. And in a sense, that's what Croft Erica had in mind when he talked about the extraterrestrial imperative, isn't it, Cody?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that has been the nature of man from our existence, is that we're constantly expanding and changing our boundary conditions. You know, whether it's moving from Europe to then the New World, and then from the East Coast to the West Coast, to now out to the Moon, next on to Mars and beyond. If man is not exploring, if man is not discovering, then he is not acting as man was intended to be.
We've even proven that you can make a livable terrain out of the area around Houston, Texas. Although it's not always so livable. Well, let me thank the two of you. This has been most fascinating discussion. I mean, we're partly breaking new ground with these recent programs with Sky Shields, with this one, with Michael Kirsch recently, because what I'm trying to do with the LaRouche Show is bring up these breaking scientific discussions on what is essentially a radio format. And so I would encourage people who are intrigued or interested in these things to go to the LaRouche PAC website and look at some of the articles, go to the Executive Intelligence Review for the April 23rd issue, I believe it is, see Peter's article so you can read through it, and then keep your eyes peeled for the upcoming video series on basic scientific questions on LaRouche PAC TV, because these are the issues that will determine whether civilization advances or not. Now, at the same time, do your job to get Obama impeached and get the LaRouche plan through, and that includes building the audience for the webcast next Saturday to hear Lyndon LaRouche take up the question of where do we go from here if we intend to save civilization. So Peter and Cody, thank you very much for joining us today.
All right, thank you.
And we'll have you on again soon as these revolutions unfold. So join us next Saturday. Actually, don't join us next Saturday. Join Lyndon LaRouche next Saturday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. And we'll be back with you.